This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. To some degree, all of us model ourselves on or measure ourselves against the people we meet in books. And whether you chose Holden Caulfield or Holly Golightly probably says more than a little about who you are or want to be. Book Magazine assembled a panel of authors and other figures in the publishing industry and put together a list of the 100 greatest fictional characters of the 20th century. This hour, we want to hear your choices. Who should be on that list and why? What does that character mean to you? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Remember, we are talking about 20th century fiction, so Tom and Huck are out. Sherlock Holmes just sneaks in. He was published in 1902. Just as important as who you choose is why. What makes a good character in literature great? What are the elements of a character who sticks with you as opposed to one you forget about the day you finish the book? We also wondered what it might be like to gather a few of these characters together for a discussion. So toward the end of the hour, we're going to call in a few listeners who feel they know their favorite characters well enough to play them for a few minutes on the radio. Again, our telephone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And our first caller is Sandra, who joins us from O'Fallon, Illinois. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Who's your nominee?
I've got two of them. Harry Potter, for bringing children back to literature, and Sam Gamgee from The Lord of the Rings. He was Frodo's sidekick and showed what faithfulness in a friend can do for you.
Well, Book Magazine Editor-in-Chief Jerome Kramer is with us this hour from our studio in New York. Welcome, Jerome. Jerome, are you there?
I am.
Harry Potter and Sam Gamgee make your list?
Well, it's funny. Harry did, which delighted a lot of people, I think, and Sam didn't, which angered a fair number of people. Sam was certainly in contention, but he didn't make it, and I have to say, neither did Frodo or Gandalf.
None of the Baggins family made it.
It's democracy in action. So,
did anyone in Lord of the Rings make it?
No, they were all in contention, but they didn't make the top 100.
Your criteria were set up. Well, we described some of them. Were there more restrictions than we have listed?
No, really, it was purely a matter of taste and whimsy. The one thing that went into it that made it somewhat scientific is the breadth of people that we approached to put together the original list, and then the balloting was conducted by 100 people or more.
Mm-hmm. Who'd you include?
Actors. Oh, a wide range of people from, Griffin Dunn and Dennis Farina to Sue Miller and actors, writers, producers, directors. Just to try to get a sense across the board of how people felt they'd been affected by characters who they then lived the rest of their lives with, in a sense.
Sandra, why was Harry Potter important to you?
Well, other than being a delightful book, it brought children back to bookstores. I mean, children were lined up for blocks to get those books. Now, my kids both read voraciously, but to see kids that normally don't pick up a book pick one up.
Well, I could see
that
making...
character is so compelling.
I could see that making him an important character, but not necessarily a great one.
But memorable, certainly, right, Sandra?
Memorable, and he also showed how you can stay a good person in the face of adversity and conquer what has been done to you.
And don't you think part of the appeal of Harry is that while we've got four books under our belts, as it were, we've got another three promised. So it's a lot of fun to think about having that much of an experience with a character.
Oh, I can't wait. I mean, my son won't let us read it until he's read each one. But
there has to be a pecking order.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And he gets to read it first.
Okay.
Well, that's the way it should be, I think.
Sandra, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Now let's go to Marie, who's in Wausau, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, hello. Don't laugh, but my nominee is for Nancy Drew.
That's good. That's good. She didn't make it either, but that's a great nomination.
Okay, why Nancy Drew?
Well, I mean, I'm probably not different from a lot of girls, but when I was little, for, you know, when I was in second and third grade, I mean, I used to read my books over and over, and I just wanted to be Nancy Drew.
I think that's a common experience in a lot of ways. We're actually putting together a piece for an upcoming issue of the magazine right now about a series of detective stories for kids, including the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, and I don't think you can overestimate the impact those characters had on generations of readers.
Right. Well, thanks.
Thanks very much for the call, and Nancy would be proud of you.
Yeah, I'm sure she would.
Okay, thanks very much. Email from Shoshana Francis, who writes, Katie Scarlett O'Hara Hamilton Kennedy Butler could kick Gatsby's butt with her stays on. And I guess she knows that Jay Gatsby, from obviously The Great Gatsby, that's character number one on the list.
That's right.
And why did Jay Gatsby, do you think, get number one?
Well, I think Gatsby, Jay Gatz, has been making a huge impression on people for decades. He's not only an inscrutable, engaging character within the novel, and at that, a novel that an awful lot of people have been forced to read against their will and then fall in love with in high school and college and so on. But the book and Gatsby, by extension, represents this kind of a storied golden moment in the country's development that I think people get pulled back into when they're reading the book. So Gatsby stands in for all that and just becomes somebody that you'd like to share in that mysterious engagement of getting to know him and trying to figure him out. And then, of course, you know, tragedy always helps make a character
little
sink
richer
into your head.
Yeah. For those who've forgotten just how beguiling Jay Gatsby could be, here's a description of him as described in the book. Here's a reading.
He smiled understandingly, much more than understandingly. It was one of those rare smiles with a quality of eternal reassurance in it that you may come across four or five times in life. It faced, or seemed to face, the whole external world for an instant, and then concentrated on you with an irresistible prejudice in your favor. It understood you just so far as you wanted to be understood, believed in you as you would like to believe in yourself, and assured you that it had precisely the impression of you that, at your best, you hoped to convey. Precisely at that point, it vanished, and I was looking at an elegant young roughneck, a year or two over 30, whose elaborate formality of speech just missed being absurd. Sometime before he introduced himself, I'd got a strong impression that he was picking his words with care.
That a description of Jay Gatsby, character number one. Jerome Kramer, what about Scarlett O'Hara? Did she make the list?
Number 23, and a very strong 23 at that. Scarlett is certainly a character that our audience has expressed many times how much they love. She has a fierce following. We've run afoul of it a couple of times when we didn't include Gone with the Wind on this list or that. And I think she's a remarkable character and one who, again, connects with a whole image that people enjoy, as well as having been a very strong individual.
Scarlett O'Hara and, of course, Rhett Butler, familiar to all of us from the movies.
Oh, Rhett, I was so distressed when I heard you were in jail. I simply couldn't sleep for thinking. It's not true they're going to hang you.
Would you be sorry?
Oh, Rhett.
Well, don't worry. Yet. The Yankees have trumped up some charge against me, but what they're really after is my money. They seem to think I made off with the Confederate treasury.
Well, did you?
Well, what a leading question. Well, let's just talk about sordid things like money. How good of you to come and see me. And how pretty you look.
Oh, Red, how you do run on teasing a country girl like me?
Thank heavens you're not in rags. I'm tired of seeing women in rags.
Jerome Miller, what about Rhett? Did he make it?
Rhett did not make it.
So, frankly, your panel didn't give a damn?
Well, I think, again, he's on the list of contenders, but not in that top 100. I tell you, getting it down to that final 100 was tough and certainly meant leaving off some people that some of the voters, as well as people who've come across the piece, you know, would argue vociferously against having abandoned.
For those of you struggling with the great American novel, you may wonder, how do authors come up with memorable characters? Are they pure figments of an imagination, composites of people they know? How do you get inside a character's head and imagine their lives? How do you recognize a great character if you do come up with one? Well, here to tell us about characters and character development is Sue Miller, the best-selling author of The Good Mother. Her latest novel is The World Below, and she was among the panelists who voted on the top 100 characters. And Sue Miller joins us now on the line from her home in Boston. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So if it was up to you, would Rhett Butler be on the list? This is an easy question.
You know, one of the things that Liz taught me was how many books I haven't read, and I haven't read that one, so I'm not sure whether he would have or not.
No, see, you would not have allowed yourself to vote simply on the strength of the movie.
I also never saw the movie.
Well, 0-2. Who did you vote for? Who was your number one?
So? I had Jay Gatsby, like everyone else, I guess, as number one.
I got to say, Sue really, as they say in presidential elections, you know, as goes such and such a state, so goes the entire election. Sue had a remarkable success rate in her ballot.
Yeah, I'm astonished, and then disappointed at the few that didn't make it.
Well, most of your protagonists tend to be women, mothers. How much of your own experience do you put into them?
Well, I think I use a lot of my own experience, but I don't sort of use myself. I mean, they are not me, and they're very carefully different from me. I mean, I protect myself very well from a sense of identification with them by making them different from me.
Now, when you've come up with characters, well, first of all, do you come up with characters first or a plot first?
I really sort of work around sort of an idea for a story first, so a plot first, I guess, in a certain sense. And then I know that I've got to have a character. I sort of figure out what the character needs to be like in order to make this plot work, you know, sort of who will carry the weight of the plot, essentially. But that's still pretty sketchy. I mean, it's like being told about someone ahead of time that, you know, you're going to meet at a dinner party. Well, he's sort of charming but shallow. And you still, I mean, there are lots and lots of ways of being charming but shallow. And I think it isn't until you actually start to write the character and to put his voice on the page and to have him interact with other people that you begin to know him, just as you don't begin to know a person in life until you start to talk to him and interact with him. And then,
well, sometimes do they run away with the plot that you've already laid out? I mean, you realize, oh, my gosh, this character would never do that.
Well, then I just change him, actually. I'm very controlling. I do know people who say that that characters do sort of overwhelm them and take over and so forth, but that's not something that's happened to me. I mean, there's a wonderful line from Grace Paley, none of whose wonderful characters were on this list, but she called her characters in my hearing once her employees. They do what she tells them to do, and I feel the same way about mine. They belong to me, and they do what I tell them to do.
If you get a good one, though, can that character take on a voice in your head and talk to you, argue with you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But I win the argument almost invariably. I mean, occasionally something will occur to me that seems wonderful, and I'll accommodate it in the book, but I wouldn't change the book for a character.
Well, Sue Miller, since your list accorded so well with the magazine's list, can you stay on with us for a little while?
I will, sure.
All right, we'll take some calls from more listeners after we get back from a short break. Our telephone number, of course, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about the greatest characters in literature since 1900, and we'll be taking more of your calls. Who is your favorite, and why are there great characters in the literature of other cultures and languages that most Americans aren't aware of? I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking this hour about the 100 most important characters in 20th century fiction. Our guest is Jerome Kramer. He's editor of Book Magazine, which compiled the list. You can see it, by the way, on our website, www.npr.org. Who do you think should be on the list? Also with us, author Sue Miller. And our next caller is Jennifer, who's on the line with us from Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
How you doing?
All right.
All right, I have two words, Atticus Finch. I'm a high school English teacher, and one book that just seems to stick with my kids is that one, and I think Atticus is just a really commendable person. He's terrific. I think a lot of our young boys need a good role model in their lives, and he certainly seems to fit that bill.
Jerome Kramer, Atticus Finch make the list?
He did. In fact, To Kill a Mockingbird, I believe, was the most represented book on the list. Atticus made it, Scout made it, Boo Radley made it.
Wow.
Three from that one book.
Eight.
And Boo Radley does not have an awful lot of lines in that book.
That's true.
Hardly any, but I think most of my students seem to remember him the most. I see my ninth graders as they move on through the years, and they always bring that book up, and Boo is always in the conversation. They seem to connect with him.
Sue Miller, was Atticus Finch among your nominees?
He wasn't. I think perhaps I'm a little too old. I think I got out of high school before that book was published, and so the sort of most vulnerable age for reading it, I'd already passed by the time I might have read it.
Well, Jennifer, these are obviously characters of living importance to your students.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I'll keep teaching it.
Well, thanks very much.
Excellent.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Bonnie in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
Hi.
Hi.
My nominee is Howard Rourke from The Fountainhead.
Ayn Rand's book, The Fountainhead.
Absolutely. I first read it over 40 years ago as a teenager. And it's a book I revisit about every 10 to 15 years. I've turned other kids that I know, you know, that come through my life. And I remember him so well because of his strong sense of self.
Mm-hmm. Now, I sometimes get my Rand books confused. Was he the architect?
Yes, he was.
Uh-huh. Okay. Jerome Kramer, is Howard Rourke on the list?
He's not.
He's not.
No. He, certainly Rand's a terrifically important writer and has a huge following, but he did not make the list.
Did any of her characters, John Galt or any of those other people?
Now, who is John Galt? That's a joke. Okay. Sue Miller, do you read any of Ayn Rand's books and think of her?
I did. I read The Fountainhead. And actually, I mean, I think he is a very memorable character. Maybe we all suffered a little from the sense of rejection of the politics there somehow. I don't know that he didn't make it.
Well, it was the individualism.
Oh, no, I agree.
I think it's a good point.
I think as a teenager, when your mother is always telling you, you don't have to do what everybody else does, and then you read a book like this, I think it had a great effect on me. And I, as I say, it's a book I revisit every 10 or 15 years.
Well, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye.
Jerome Kramer, as we're thinking about this, did more recent characters tend to do better than older ones?
No. I would say we had a few characters from the 90s. We talked about Harry Potter a moment ago. Hannah from The English Patient, Michael Ondaatje's masterpiece, is on the list. But for the most part, there was a pretty good distribution across the, 102, 103 years since 1900.
Sue Miller, if there was one more name you could add to the list, who would it be?
I had inserted Isabel Archer, who was not from Portrait of the Lady, who I don't think did. She didn't make it, did she at all, Gerard?
No, she didn't.
Yeah, which surprised me enormously. And then sort of afterwards, I thought of several other characters and from books that weren't mentioned at all. There's a wonderful book by Christina Stead called The Man Who Loved Children. And all three of the main characters in that book are very powerful. I mean, I still remember them as though I'd known them, to my horror. And I think also a couple of other James characters, like Daisy Miller.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing about this whole project, was it reminds you of these people in your lives. They go, I think, for many people, far beyond being characters that you think of as existing on a page, and they become individuals that have really played a role in your life.
I think the comment about the about Howard Rourke is very apt. I mean, I think when you feel attached to a character, they live with you forever. I mean, and particularly, I think those characters that you read in adolescence.
That is
Atticus Finch, and probably Holden Caulfield is on that list too. Someone who most people my age and younger have read in adolescence, and he's just an incredibly important part of our adolescence. Therefore,
and unlike us, they don't change a lot.
Well, that's the great thing. We're talking about the idea of revisiting a character periodically, every 10 years. And the finite element in the character doesn't change. The page doesn't change. But what you can take away from that character can grow and change with time, and that's one of the wonders of it.
I think you do read. I mean, it is amazing when you come back to something that you've been terribly impressed by and engaged with, and sort of realize, well, this is really a very shallow person. and I think it's sometimes very pleasurable to mark your own growth in that way, too, and your retreat from a character.
Well, Sue Miller, I assume you're busy at work on the greatest character of the next 100 years.
I hope so.
Thanks you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure
to be here.
Sue Miller, the author of The Good Mother, While I Was Gone, and The World Below, among other works of fiction. She was one of Book Magazine's panelists, and she spoke with us on the line from her home in Boston. Here's some email questions. This from Click in San Francisco. Were there any science fiction characters on the list? If so, who? I would nominate Molly Lurbain, also known as Sally Shears and Molly Millions, a character from William Gibson's cyberpunk world. Of course, she wouldn't make it. A high-priced razor girl with an amped-up nervous system who can control any situation when she walks in the room, but it's always working for someone else and none too happy about it. Science fiction characters?
A few, but probably, in all honesty, underrepresented, certainly in the minds of a lot of speculative fiction aficionados.
You used the $40 term.
It's supposed to be. We've been reprimanded for saying sci-fi. That's apparently not the right term.
Only readers say that. Joe March, I actually managed to wear the cover off my hardcover edition of Little Women, that from Elizabeth Schwint.
That's great.
Yeah. Did she make it?
No, as a matter of fact.
Another science fiction character, speculative fiction character. Arthur Dent of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is the everyman surviving and thriving in the most challengingly absurd of circumstances from one end of time to the other and back. John in Seattle, who knows the answer to the question of what is the meaning of life?
Yeah. Didn't make it.
Yep. It should have been number 42, obviously.
Right.
The Lorax, for witnessing but not participating, for holding on to the memory and not letting go, for passing the seed of hope to the future, and for having the strength to do so. Very nicely put by Eduardo R. Maglioni, a program officer at the San Antonio Housing Trust Foundation.
Didn't make it, but certainly some of the Lorax's colleagues did.
The Cat in the Hat, for one.
Yes.
Okay, so at least a representative from the rhymed couplet world.
Right.
Okay. The logical extension of a great character is the work of a great character actor. Here's Tom Wilkinson as the father in the movie In the Bedroom.
Oh, my God, what happened?
Frank, hold still.
Dad. This was her husband, wasn't it?
Ex. Dropped in.
You gonna press charges?
No.
Well, what's to stop him from doing it again?
Come on, did you hit him at all? Come on, tell me you hit him.
Matt.
Just so he doesn't do it again.
I don't think I touched him. Ah, Jesus, Dad.
So what are you going to do?
Take karate?
Oh, that is not the problem.
Mom, you know you like her.
I like a lot of people, Frank. Did you call the police?
Oh, yeah.
You didn't call them?
Well, he just got in when I had a chance to call the police.
No, Mom, no, don't call them.
Tom Wilkinson is up for Best Actor at the Academy Awards this Sunday for his portrayal of Matt, the husband in The Bedroom. That movie was one of the year's surprise hits. It's been nominated for 5 Oscars total. Tom Wilkinson's other screen credits include Shakespeare in Love, The Full Monty, and The Patriot. And he joins us now on the line from Los Angeles. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's nice to be here. Lovely.
Who would your favorite fictional character have been? Who would you have nominated for this list?
Oh, fictional character.
Yeah, a fictional character of the 20th century.
I think probably, who would I go for? Holden Caulfield?
Holden Caulfield, Jerome Kramer came in 2nd on your list.
Oh, right.
Yes. So, by the way, congratulations on your nomination.
Thank you.
Now, your background is in the British stage, where they do things quite a bit differently. How do you feel about all of the glitz and glamour? Have you been besieged by packs of young women as you're going about waiting for the Oscar ceremony?
Oh, I wish. One of the terrible things about being, the pact that you make with the Lord, and it says, yes, Tom, you will be a movie star, but you'll be 54 years old and happily married. So now the young girls haven't been there, but I've enjoyed it. It's been a wonderful ride, and I know that at the end of, in a week's time, I go home and resume my mundane life in London.
As you look at the characters presented to you, I guess, in the form of either plays or screenplays, how do you decide, what tells you whether somebody's good, a good, rich character?
It's a sort of process of, it's a moment of recognition. It's not something you kind of think about. You almost know straight away whether you want to play that character or not. And it's just, as I said, it's just an instant of recognition where you think, oh, yes, I know this. I know exactly how this works.
So it could be as simple as a mannerism or an accent or something like that?
It could be that. It's just usually when you can somehow see right into the center of the character and you understand how it works and you feel that you could, you could do quite a lot of interesting riffs on that central theme.
Now, if your character comes from a book, do you then read the book to get a better feel for the character, or just read the script?
I will tend to read the script. I don't know that reading the book is that useful. And there's nothing more tiresome than starting rehearsing a scene and one of the actors comes in and says, actually, in the book, my character has much more to say that they have here in the script. No, you work from the script, and that's all you've got. And sometimes it could be useful to read the book if you were just not sure about something. But as a general rule, I don't.
Now, there are other times, I'm sure, when you're reading a book just for pleasure, not necessarily for work, and you say, now there is somebody I would like to play.
Yeah.
And who are those?
Well, I rather foolishly read a book on holiday some years ago, which was a wonderful, wonderful book, and I thought, this is perfect for me. I could play this central character. I know how this central character works. I'm going to get my agent to see if they can track it down and see if we can get the rights and so on. So I did that. 2 weeks later, she came back. She said, the rights have gone. They belong to Steven Spielberg. And that book was called Schindler's List.
Ah, well, now that you're a big Hollywood name, Oscar nominated, presumably you've got the industry muscle to get your own projects like that.
I suppose, but I'm probably too lazy to do that. It's very difficult. You say you want. It's very rare that you do read something and think, "Oh yes, I could. That's good. This is good. This will make it." You might like the character, but the story won't work as a film, and so on and so forth.
But if there was one character you could get to play, money being no object, who would that be?
You've put me on the spot. Off the top of my head, I would like to do a. I like stories about teachers. Those always fascinate me, and the movies that I've seen about teachers always have an extra fascination for me, and I don't quite know why. At the same time, I like submarine stories.
So Captain Nemo might be your next part.
Yes.
Tom Wilkinson, a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
And good luck at the Oscars.
Thank you very much.
Tom Wilkinson, nominated for an Academy Award for his role as Matt Fowler in The Bedroom. Other film credits, Shakespeare in Love and The Full Monty. He spoke with us from Los Angeles, where he's awaiting Sunday's Oscar ceremony and hopefully the Best Actor Award. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our guest is Jerome Kramer, the editor of Book Magazine. We're talking about the 100 greatest characters of 20th century fiction. And let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Norbert in Cleveland.
I'm on hold so long, I forgot who my character was.
I see.
Anyway, I would nominate Rabbit Angstrom from Updike's Angstrom, or rather Rabbit series. He's
from Rabbit Run all the way through what? Rabbit Gets Rich?
Rabbit is Rich and Rabbit at Rest.
I see, yes. I forgot the last one.
And Rabbit Redux. And he has the ability to portray, I guess, a kind of every man that drags you through that particular decade the book deals with, and does it with a lot of humor and insight. And they're fun books, and I think you can almost identify with the character.
Rabbit Angstrom, Jerome Kramer, did he make the list?
Rabbit Angstrom did make the list. He's actually number 5, so he's in the top of the selections, and I think a very good choice by all the voters for the reasons just mentioned. He's a really engaging character, and one who has served John Updike very well. Updike's had a lot of fun, I think, doing a piece every decade, which kind of captures that the tumult of that decade in America.
Good job, precisely. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Norbert, why is he important to you?
Because it just covers so much of that particular contemporary scene, and it's so well done, and you just can't forget them. It's hard to put in words. You have to read it.
Well, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now let's go to Rick, who's on the line in San Diego.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Rick.
I would nominate Ignatius Riley from Confederacy of Dunces.
You would have a winner as well.
John Kennedy O'Toole.
Yes.
And why is he important to you?
Well, he basically captures the carnivalesque essence of what a lot of people consider literature to be, mm-hmm. as well as his location of New Orleans.
Yeah.
The hunting cap, the grand romantic dialogue that he has with himself and others. He basically just lives in his own world and creates it as he goes, regardless of what the world throws at him or, you know.
Was that one of those books important to you when you were a young man?
No, actually, I've been reading my whole life, as most people have, but I just picked that book up last summer, and not many books can make me just laugh out loud.
Hmm,
that's right.
The character or the circumstances, and I wish Toole were still around, because he's a treasure, and so is Ignatius.
You were going to say, Jerome?
Well, Toole, I think, really managed to create one of those rare characters who's much larger than life, but still seems somehow very realistic.
Hmm. Rick, thanks for the call.
Oh, you're welcome.
We're talking about the 100 best characters in fiction since 1900. Our guest is Jerome Kramer, editor-in-chief of Book Magazine. You can continue this conversation online. Go to npr.org, click on the discussion section, then scroll down to Talk of the Nation. Coming up, 3 listeners try their hand at improvising literary characters. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org, the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life to explore how religion shapes ideas and institutions, pewforum.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the 1930s and 40s, Yiddish radio was all over the New York airwaves.
WEVD, New York.
This is Ward, WARD.
WBBC, Brooklyn, New York.
WCNW, operating on
the Yiddish Radio Project has rescued hundreds of hours of old radio shows, programs that offer a window onto an almost forgotten world. The Yiddish Radio Project, later today, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow at this time, the buzz behind this year's Academy Awards. People are talking about the controversy behind the Best Picture nominations, and for the first time, three African Americans are nominated in acting categories. Today, we are talking about the top 100 characters in fiction with Jerome Kramer, editor-in-chief of Book Magazine, which put together the list. If you'd like to see a copy of that list, by the way, just go to our website, www.npr.org. And to get in on the conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-TALK, or send us email, TOTN@npr.org. And yesterday we asked you listeners to tell us which fictional character you'd like to play. Well, we had some auditions. Our casting director has selected three characters, and we're going to put your imagination and acting skills to the test. And joining us now, playing the wizard Gandalf of the J.R.R. Tolkien books, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, is Art Turner of Rockford, Illinois. Gandalf was not on the top 100 list, but a number of you voted for him. And Gandalf the Grey, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's very good to be here today.
The Cat in the Hat will also join us. The Cat in the Hat did make the 100 top list. He's going to be played by Kevin Paul in Durham, North Carolina. Kevin sent in a poem as his audition. Before we get to our improvisational part, we're going to ask Kevin to read that poem on the air. Do I call you Cat? Would you take it away?
Certainly, Neil. The phone did not ring. I had nothing to say. So I sat in the apartment on that cold, wet Tuesday. I sat there alone. I sat there staring at the wall. And I said how I wish Toten would call. Too wet to go out and too cold to play ball. So I sat in the apartment. I did nothing at all. So all I could do was to sit. And I did not like it, not one little bit. Ring. And then something went ring. How that ring made me sing. I listened. Then I heard them say it was Toten. And I listened. And I heard him. It was Neil Conan.
Okay. Now joining us is Lucia, the protagonist of the Map and Lucia series by E.F. Benson. She did not make the top 100 list either. Those books were made into a PBS series. Lucia is going to be played by Lisa Grant of Providence, Rhode Island. And Lucia, welcome to you to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you so very much.
And we wanted to get together and have a conversation with these three characters and, of course, with Jerome Kramer, since our three literary characters have absolutely nothing in common apart from this program. We've picked a topic for you to discuss, and it is tomorrow's subject, the Oscars. Lucia, as a proper young woman, you must like perhaps Gosford Park as Best Picture.
Actually, I think it's wonderful, and I have no doubt that something from our country will win.
And Gandalf, I wonder if you thought you were portrayed fairly in The Fellowship of the Rings. That's also up for Best Picture this year.
I feel that Sir Ian McKellen did a most outstanding job in portraying me.
He managed to get his voice even lower than yours.
Yes.
Not easy.
Yes, he did.
Cat in the Hat, new category at the Oscars this year, the Best Animated Picture.
Yes, exactly. And if there's one thing that I wanted to say on the Oscar day, heck, give it to Shrek.
How delightful that would be in Italiano.
In Italiano. Well, Gandalf the Grey, there was an animated version of Lord of the Rings earlier, wasn't there?
Yes, that is my understanding.
And was this up to the character of the current movie?
I do not feel that it was quite an accurate representation of myself and my peers in the realm of Middle Earth, but it was nonetheless a most engaging effort.
That's very kind of you. Clearly, a wizard who plans to make no enemies whatsoever.
I do not care to at this time, no.
Mm-hmm. Cat in the Hat, I'm curious, as you look at the nominees for Best Actor, does anything, you'll excuse the expression, jump out at you?
Well, the tension is thick. You could cut it with a knife. Denzel's evil on screen, but Russell's bad in real life.
You know, if Shakespeare had been able to qualify, we could make you do that in iambic pentameter. I wonder, Lucia, best foreign film, that's something that you'd be interested in.
Yes. But then again, it's hard to actually say what a foreign film is, isn't it? Since the Americans on this side of the ocean tend to class British films that way sometimes.
Lucia, do you feel slighted by the fact that a composition has been made, the 100 greatest characters of 20th century fiction, and I'm sorry to say you're not on it?
Do you know, I was actually quite shocked, because Gandolfino mio, you have, I believe, 3 books, do you not?
Gandalf?
Yes, actually, I think it is quite presumptuous of this book magazine to not include the great Gandalf the Grey.
And do you know that I actually have 7 books? 7.
And The Cat in the Hat has probably the... I'm not meaning to slight either of your characters or their authors, but I suspect The Cat in the Hat is the most read aloud, certainly.
That's perhaps correct. I read the list. I read it today. I made the list. There's nothing to say.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us on this excursion into improvisation with your characters. And if you could step out of character just to rejoin us for just a moment.
Sure.
Okay. And we wanted to ask each of you, first of all, those of you who portrayed these, why, for example, was Gandalf the Grey so important to you?
Lord of the Rings is a book. The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings are books that I read in junior high school, and just the most masterful fantasy I've ever read, and nothing that I've read since is compared to just kind of the scope and grandeur of those books in my mind.
Lisa? I agree with you, Art. I just, for what it's worth, I would say that, in fact, on my ballot, I voted along with these other dozens and dozens of people. Gandalf was number 7 on my list. So democracy, can overwhelm even the best judgments.
Sure.
Lisa Grant?
Yes.
And why? What was important to you about Lucia?
About Lucia?
Yeah.
Well, I think someone, the New York Times book review said it best. Never again will the provincial rich of England between the wars be depicted so perfectly, so forcefully, and with such devastating humor. If you haven't read the series, you absolutely should grab all of the Map and Lucia books by E.F. Benson.
And Kevin Paul, our applause to you from everybody involved in this program. A tremendous performance as The Cat in the Hat.
Absolutely.
Thank you. The pressure was on.
Yes, it was.
Lived up to it.
And I think we all know why The Cat in the Hat was probably important to you, probably more than once.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I'm here at Duke in law school, and it's a great place, but I wouldn't call it exactly fun. And I think a lot of people need escapes. And ever since I've been young, I've been able to amuse myself, and it's just good to escape and get away from reality sometimes.
Well, again, thanks to all of you for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
Thanks a lot.
And as Lucia would say, au reservoir.
Jerome Kramer, why don't we finish up the emails? This is from Charles Miller. My vote goes to Stephen Dedalus, James Joyce's young aesthete. I respect his intellect and his unstinting devotion to art and beauty. I would also vote for Tyrone Slothrop, Thomas Pynchon's main protagonist, whose misadventures and odyssey throughout World War II Europe verge on insanity and burlesque. I admire his trickster-like resilience. Stephen Dedalus, did he make it?
He did.
And Thomas Pynchon's character, Slothrop?
He did not.
From Risa Pyler, a National Board Certified Teacher, Zora Neale Hurston did the female gender a great favor when she created Janie Mae Crawford Killick's Stark Woods, whew, in her novel Their Eyes Were Watching God. Did Janie make it?
She did.
Good for her. Looking at the list, I'd like to take a moment to voice an opinion for characters who are not good role models. Humbert Humbert, for example. That from Charlotte Freeman. Humbert Humbert made it, didn't he?
He did indeed.
Did Lolita?
She did as well.
Okay.
We're all about bad role models.
David Simon writes, okay, I have a weird, obscure one that I'm sure didn't turn up on anyone's list. There's a challenge. Bonanza Jellybean from Even Cowboys Get the Blues.
That is correct. Bonanza did not make the list.
Jerome Kramer, thank you so much for joining us today. And when did this list come out, by the way?
It's just out. It's in the... it's in the current issue of the magazine, the March-April issue. It's on newsstands now, book, or you can go to bookmagazine.com.
And you can see the list on our website. That's NPR, www.npr.org. And Jerome Kramer, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Neil.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Reading is not only fundamental, it's now fashionable. A new trend is spreading city to city, and it's having everybody read the same book. The idea began, like so many trends, on the West Coast in the readingest city of them all, Seattle. Joining us now on the line from Seattle is Nancy Pearl, Executive Director of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nancy Pearl, what is Seattle reading this year?
This year, Seattle is reading a wonderful novel set at the turn of the 20th century called Wildlife by Molly Gloss.
How many people are participating?
Oh, I would say several thousands.
And how do you know that? How do you count them?
We count the people who come to the programs at which the author appears and talks with the audience about the book. So this is not a reading. This is not with the author reading selections from the book. This is an author who comes and says, let's talk about my book, which you've all read. And so we count those people who come to that, to those particular programs. We also know how many book clubs are using the many copies of the books that we have bought for that use, book clubs throughout the Seattle area. And then the many people who don't particularly want to talk about the book but still want to read and think about it.
Is the idea of this that after a while, enough people will have read this book that you can run into somebody in the street and said, you know, that scene in the school, that was really great.
I think that was one of the original intents. We have buttons that say, I'm reading Russell Banks for the first year. I'm mm-hmm. Cooling with Words with Bill Moyers, which was our third year in poetry. And we kind of always pictured that people waiting for a bus, especially, and the bus system in Seattle is very heavily used, that people would say, yeah, what did you think about that? Or especially in the case of Wildlife, were those really Sasquatches that she met on that mountain? So it has really, this was always about reading and discussing a work of literature. And we talk about the book in terms of course, its themes, but also why we think the author arranged the book the way mm-hmm. he or she did.
Who gets to pick the book?
Well, there's a very small committee, and of which I am a member.
I see.
And we have two major criteria. One is that the book make for a very good discussion, and the other that the author be comfortable in talking with an audience, not to an audience.
So it has to be a living author.
For us, it does. And
I was going to go for W. Somerset Maugham for Seattle, but
I know. People, the first year when we were trying to figure out what book we wanted to use, we ended up selecting Russell Banks, The Sweet Hereafter, which was a wonderful book, and after September 11th, I think, has even greater importance for readers than it did 4 years ago. But the first year, everyone, I would say, well, what do you think we ought to read? What do you think we ought to read? Universally, the answer would be anything by Wallace Stegner. And I would have to say, well, he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have difficulty channeling that presence back.
Now, after you came up with the idea for One Book, One City a few years ago, several other cities have followed your lead.
Yes, Chicago, Rochester, Buffalo, Jamestown, New York. They're reading, I think, what's my favorite selection, Pudd'nhead Wilson.
That author is unavailable.
I know. Most of those other cities don't. That's not a prerequisite for their selections.
I see. So Washington, D.C. could select a Dante, for example?
If they were so inclined. I think Harold Bloom would enjoy that.
Now, what's the best kind of a book for a whole city to read? Any suggestions?
The best kind of book would be a book that is character-driven. That is, a lot of books are fun to read.
Mm-hmm. Plot-driven, yeah.
Right, like many of the bestsellers. But what we're looking for is a book in which the characters face a difficult situation or they are striving for something that will, in the end, give them happiness or grief, mm-hmm. but something in which the characters are so three-dimensional that it's hard not to not only identify with them, but empathize with them, I think.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Nancy Pearl, Executive Director of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Seattle started the One City, One Book reading craze back in 1998. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.